Welcome to the Carson City Building for the Supreme Court of Nevada. Our first case is case number 69995, a bid versus a bid, child custody case. Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones.
Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, Radford Smith on behalf of Ludmila Pinskova, formerly Ms. Abid. So the case starts with the notion that it was a crime. There were a series, in fact, of crimes that were committed in this domestic relations matter. The statute is 206.50. It prevents surreptitious taping of a third party's conversation. It also makes it a crime to attempt to do so. In this case, significantly important is it makes a crime to disclose the existence, content, substance, purport, effect, or meaning of any conversation so listened to, monitored, or recorded.
Mr. Smith, I hate to interrupt you, but is there a penalty provision there as far as any recommended sentence? What's the punishment?
I believe that there is a punishment. I believe it's a Category C, but I'm not certain of that.
Couldn't find it.
Okay. So in this instance, however, it is clear that this falls under the criminal statute. And it has been used in other civil cases to actually dismiss the entirety of a case when utilized improperly. In other words, the evidence in the Lane versus Ball State case was submitted in violation of that statute. But the court actually dismissed the case, finding that use of this type of information.
Well, it was actually reversed and remanded for the exclusion of those references. It wasn't dismissed.
But the case was ultimately, I think the case was ultimately dismissed.
Okay.
Mr. Smith, I appreciate the fact that you are labeling this a crime and proceeding under that. But I guess we're still dealing with child custody, and we're still dealing with the best interest of the child. So if you could parse that into this argument, I would appreciate that.
So if we have, the question becomes, was the information that was contained in this illegally obtained tape utilized by the court in order to enter her ultimate judgment? I don't think there's any doubt that there was, because the report was based in part on this tape. Now, let's remember that the expert who testified acknowledged that illegally obtained tapes are not regularly used by experts in her field. That leveled it outside of the requirements of Chapter 50 in regard to the use of expert information. She testified that way. She admitted that was true. There was no finding to suggest otherwise. Nevertheless, even though after that voir dire we sought to exclude the report, the court admitted the report. One of the questions that's in the synopsis is, was this harmless error? It was not harmless because the report itself used the information contained in the tape to reach its conclusions. Although, arguably, the conclusions were simply that there should be more study of this issue, because Dr. Holland recognized that she didn't have enough information to even recommend a change of custody. Not only was the order of the court out of left field, it was out of the building across the street from left field. It was not recommended by the expert. She admitted she didn't have sufficient data. We had cited in our briefing the statutes associated with the American Psychologist Association guidelines for forensic psychologists. In those guidelines, there is limits on what is forensic psychologist recommendations. They should have multiple sources of information. Here, the only sources of information were some perfunctory interviews with the parents, but relied solely upon statements that were attributed to the child in the interviews, 4 1-hour interviews by Dr. Holland.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, sir. I don't want to conflate 50.285.
Yes.
The expert audio tapes of interviews or audio tapes of conversations would certainly be something an expert would rely upon if they were available. So I don't want to conflate the expert's use of that with the policy determination that the court had to make in terms of whether they should be permitted to do that.
Well, I think generally, I think we're making the distinction between inadmissible material and the types of inadmissible material that are regularly used by experts in her field. She testified that had she known that they were found to be illegally obtained, which they were, even though the court didn't use the words illegally obtained in its January 15th order, there is no doubt that's the conclusion, because the only excuse to this illegal taping was the fact that there was the argument that there was a doctrine that could justify the use of those tapes, the implied consent doctrine. But she didn't find that that was the case. And so what we're dealing now is the principle of whether or not illegally obtained tapes that are in violation of NRS 200650, can be utilized in that manner. In fact, the citation I think you're referring to, perhaps, is the citation in the respondent's brief where there was a series of questions. Well, don't you usually rely on these things, and don't you really know whether or not they were admissible? I would submit to you that the policy considerations underlying that statute are important enough to place a duty on the court to enter an order regarding the admissibility of such tapes prior to ever giving them to an expert. But I would also argue that the expert, he or herself, has the obligation to determine whether or not these tapes were surreptitiously obtained in violation of statute.
Okay, but go ahead, please.
That begs a question. In looking through the judge's order, the judge specifically, it appears to me anyway, specifically stays away from the tape issue. And I'm not sure that Dr. Holland was asked to give an opinion as to modification of custody. And so that's something that struck me as I was reading through the judge's order. And as I read through the order, the judge was very specific in making its factual findings based upon Dr. Holland's interview with the children, with the parents, and then applying the appropriate factors as to whether or not there should be a change of custody, and no mention of the tapes.
Well, I think
other than one reference as to what Dr. Holland relied upon.
Okay,
that didn't come out in the findings that the judge made.
Inherent to that notion is that there were none of the conclusions that were essentially quoted by the court from Dr. Holland's case. In other words, the conclusions of fact, not conclusions of how the court should actually use the expert opinion. But the facts that she claims, the statements that she attributes to the child, her conclusions regarding those statements she attributes to the child, those findings by Judge Marquis were not in a vacuum. In other words, this report quoted, in fact, has a transcript of the illegally obtained tapes, but also in the report itself, pages 1, pages 2, pages 6. And in fact, this was really a case about alienation. Alienation is pretty common when it comes to parents. It's a common argument. It's become, I would argue, even more common now that we have really a standard of joint custody. Because you can't now win primary custody without some really grave facts. So what people do over time, I will tell you, in practice, is they will alienate their children. They will do things to alienate their children so that they can win the custody in another way. So the courts are becoming very sensitive to the notion of alienation, and I get that. That makes sense. But here, the finding of alienation, or the imprimatur of alienation, because it really wasn't no finding, if you look at page 6 of the report, it's entirely based upon the statements that were made, allegedly made, on this tape by Ms. Abid. That, the fundamental concept of alienation is alienation. You can't find that a child has been alienated until you find some actual evidence of alienation. The only evidence the court relied on to find that alienation, the fundamental basis for its change of custody, was this page 6 of Dr. Holland's report, in which she specifically quoted the statements that were on the tape.
Mr. Smith, looking at page 1540 of the record, which is the second page of the judge's order, commencing at lines 5 and continuing through line 25. Is it your argument, each of those findings of fact recited by the judge come from the illegal tapes?
Yes. Well, no. They come from the report of Dr. Holland.
Well, certainly. And that says, in addition to the tapes that you reference, or the reference to the tapes on the pages you identified, not a single reference in these findings of fact comes from the tapes. Each of these, as an example, Dr. Holland relied on 4 separate interviews with the child, an interview of mom, an interview with dad, the child's medical records, email and text messages between the parties, and then goes on to say, in the next group, Dr. Holland interviewed the child on 4 occasions. Mom and dad were both allowed to bring the child an equal number of times to Holland's office. And then she says on 13, during the interviews, the child described his father as sneaky and mean. Further, the child indicated that mom told the child that the child's dad was sneaky and mean. It seems as though the judge is pointing to a lot of information developed by Dr. Holland outside of these, outside of the tape.
It depends on how you look at how Dr. Holland went about her report. Dr. Holland's report starts with the citation of the tape and the concerns she has associated with the tape. Those concerns are now evidence.
But Mr. Smith, do you have evidence that these interviews didn't take place, or that these interviews or these findings recited by the judge are not a correct characterization of the interviews that Holland had outside of the tapes?
Well, I don't have any evidence as to what the child said to Dr. Holland. We had substantial evidence in the form of the testimony of the parties, the testimony of their spouses, the testimony of teachers who saw the child for a period of 2 years. There were 2 separate teachers, none of whom corroborated any of the findings. In fact, one of the findings was this notion about the child was playing Call of Duty too much. That notion is simply wrong. The court had the record wrong because the record was unchallenged that the Xbox that he played Call of Duty on had been removed June prior to the time of the January hearing. So there were several notions here that arose specifically from conversations Dr. Holland had with the child that were uncorroborated by any other evidence. Do I know that they came from specific parts of the tape? No, the judge was very careful to avoid that statement. The judge understood what she was doing. But we can't have a report that starts in its foundation with the expert analyst believing that there was a problem in regard to the behavior of one of the parties through an illegally obtained tape, and then acting on that behavior. Did she focus on some evidence and not others? We don't know. We don't have videotapes or any kind of recordings of the transcript or the interview of the child. We just don't know. We have to now rely on 4-hour interviews when all the corroborating... I'm sorry?
Did you ask for any... notes?
Yeah, she said, we asked for notes, but we didn't, there was nothing in the notes that in other words,
Did Dr. Holland record the interviews with the child and the parents?
There was no videotape.
She refused to provide the notes?
She indicated she hadn't recorded them. No, she didn't refuse to provide the notes. She provided notes of her conversations, but the notes were somewhat cryptic and basic. They weren't a transcript that would have occurred. So, for example, what's clear about notes is I don't know what she didn't record. I don't know what else the child said about this. So, for example, the conclusions, and I understand the courts have had an opportunity to review these reports. This report makes conclusions, for example, off a single statement that was made by the child in a certain play notion. So, for example, there was the picture of the house. And then he said, well, you know, the house gets blown up. This is something that children do naturally in many circumstances, yet Dr. Holland came to the conclusion that it was evidence that she was alienated from his father. When none of the corroborating evidence, again, the teachers testified at length about his behavior, his acumen in school, his willingness to cooperate. One of the things that Dr. Holland concluded was that he wasn't going to have the ability to form reasonable relationships. The teachers, if you look at their testimony, described him as active, social. In fact, they said he was a little bit too gregarious. He wasn't in any way the person that was described in that report. And Judge Marquis completely ignored that testimony, relied only on that part that really wasn't subject to much cross-examination. I can't cross-examination an expert and say, well, gee, did you really misstate that testimony or what you attributed to the testimony of the child? So my Hobson's choice was to put a 5 or 6-year-old on the stand when the expert had already indicated that he was being damaged by the conflict between the parties. That was my choice. We chose against that, but that was what I was left with. That's not a choice anybody should make. These reports should start out unbiased, without illegally obtained evidence, and they should be reports that are based upon that corroborated information that's in the record. Thank you.
I have a question, if I might.
Sure, go ahead.
The district judge's earlier order says that the court will allow Dr. Holland to testify regarding her expert opinion in this matter, which may be based in part on the audio recordings. So you had to go to a hearing and in order to ferret out whether or not she relied on those audio recordings, you would have had to let her smuggle them in sort of like a Trojan horse if they should not have been introduced at all. I mean, how do you cross-examine that? Did you try?
I'm sorry, Justice Pickering, I'm not sure I understood the question. So, in fact, I was looking at the justice, I thought it was coming from there, so if I may, if you could possibly...
I apologize for being down here. I had a family matter that kept me here.
No, I don't mean to say that's a problem. I need to hear the question so I can answer it. I'm sorry.
Okay. If I credit your position that 50-285 does not allow an expert to rely on illegally obtained evidence that would be inadmissible because illegal, not just hearsay, but actually illegally obtained. If I credit that position, the district court judge, by her earlier order, allowed this expert to rely on that tape that you maintain was illegally obtained.
Yes.
My question to you is, how did you handle cross-examination of the expert on that point?
I've voir dire her and asked her specifically if this was the type of evidence that was regularly relied upon by experts in her field, and she said no. I quoted that in the appellant's opening brief. She didn't...
Did you explore, I'm just trying to understand how this could possibly work without a remand, because how could you explore the extent to which Dr. Holland relied on those tapes without getting into those tapes and therefore putting them in evidence even though they had been excluded?
Well, I couldn't put them in evidence, but they were, the way the court admitted them into evidence in essence was Dr. Holland's report contained a transcript of the tapes. So the tapes that were found to be illegally obtained, and let me note that, Judge, what's important about that first order is that the court made a specific finding that there was no good faith on the part of Mr. Abid in taking this tape. That's tantamount to saying there was no basis to allow a taping or no basis to believe that there was some abuse or neglect going in the home of Ms. Abid that would justify that taping. I think that's an important point. We could easily place the burden on the court to determine the admissibility of the tape before ever giving it to an expert.
Was that finding as it related to the vicarious aspect? And there was an argument that it should be admitted as some jurisdictions do.
That's an excellent question. The court found that the vicarious consent doctrine did not apply, but this is what she said after that finding. It's the quote is, even if the doctrine of vicarious consent did apply to the facts of the instant case, the court finds that Dad did not meet the threshold basis sufficient to record the communications between the minor child and Mom.
But I find that confined to that vicarious consent aspect. And it may not be good faith in a different context, but as it concerns vicarious consent, that's one of the elements, is it?
But the element is stated in the Pollock case that was quoted, and I think has been quoted by all the
Circuit case.
It says yes, and it says it's 154 F3rd 601, 6th Circuit, 1998. It says, as long as the guardian has a good faith, objectively reasonable basis for believing that it is necessary and in the best interest of the child to conduct the taping, then it can do so. But here, she found specifically he did not have a reasonable basis to do so.
And she found that even if vicarious consent applied, there was no
reasonable basis here. That's correct.
Sure.
Just briefly, Mr. Smith, when you talk about Lane is basically addressing a violation as an unfair litigation tactic. And the court dealt with what are the policy issues on how we're going to deal with this? So here, if we take that, you say the father engaged in an inappropriate and illegal litigation tactic. He wanted to get information in front of the court he wasn't entitled to. So what now? Because you're weighing the policy interest in discouraging illegal or improper litigation tactics, which the court has a whole panoply of other remedies it can address, against the policy interest in a best interest of the minor determination. I mean, if those tapes reflect something that's unsafe, for the child or not good for the child's development, is the court supposed to scrub that?
There's two questions there.
Please.
The first is whether or not this was solely a discovery issue, and if so, are there other remedies that were available to the court? Here, this is more than discovery because of the nature of domestic actions. People use tapes all the time that they take between their husbands and wives. They do that. It's become a practice now. But now we're talking about placing a tape in a backpack, in a home, where there are other residents. We're talking about more than just litigation tactics. We're talking about an absolute policy. And let me note that federal law prohibits the use of anything violative of these type of laws that prevent this type of behavior. So in regard to the discovery action, I think there's a bigger policy here. Because if you allow this, if you allow a party to surreptitiously tape record in another's home, and then you whitewash it by saying, well, he gave it to an expert, so no harm, no foul. As long as the expert doesn't reference it specifically, even though biased by it, that we're going to ignore that. That is a dangerous precedent.
But would be your position, then, that no matter what the tape said, the court should not consider it in the best interest of the minor determination? I'm not saying I agree with you. It was improper to tape, but it captured information that was extremely relevant for the court's determination about parental alienation and those things. And how does the court move forward once they have that information?
The answer, well, the court should never have received that information, because before the tape was viewed by the court, it should have made a determination as to whether or not it was illegally obtained, and it wouldn't be scrubbed. It would not be able to be used, period. That doesn't mean the person can't argue that there are problems in mom's home, that there are behavioral issues that need to be addressed, that there are classes that need to be taken, there are studies that need to be done. There needs, exactly what Dr. Holland said. Let Dr. Paglini address this with further study. That was her recommendation, not change of custody. Those are all remedies that are available to that are in the best interest of the child. To say that the language that's contained on a tape now should be whitewashed, in other words, no matter what is contained on that tape should be whitewashed, is a good policy choice. Just like we have policy choices about whether or not we look at confessions, whether or not we look at things that are illegally obtained. There are reasons why these things are more important than just some, obviously the constitutional protection on illegally obtained. But here, I'm telling you, as a domestic practitioner, it's just as important. You cannot let people do this. If they're allowed to submit tapes into somebody else's home, we now have no privacy whatsoever. The public policy associated with this rule is to prevent or to allow people to have private conversations. And I would say choose allow, so that we're not prohibited from saying things in our homes. Now, that's...
Mr. Smith, you have to wrap this up, please.
I'm sorry.
You've gone 23 and a half minutes.
I'm sorry. So
please, sit down. Thank you. Mr. Jones, I'm going to give you 20 minutes. You don't have to use the 20 minutes, but to be fair, I want to give you the 20 minutes. Mr. Smith, I'm going to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, because most of the extra time was questions from my colleagues. So.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor.
20 minutes. You have 20 minutes if you need it.
20 minutes?
Yes.
Unless there's enough questions and I need to handle them all.
Sure.
The one thing that I think has been missed here, and there's been a lot of comments by counsel and in the papers, that this was an illegal act. There has yet to be a judicial determination. There hasn't been a prosecution. But there was no determination by the district court judge that this was an illegal act. She said it didn't meet the standard for admissibility.
It was violative of the statute, and that takes me back to the question I asked Mr. Smith. What's the punishment?
Well, the punishment in this case was that the tapes were not independently admissible.
It's a strict violation of 200-650.
Well, and Your Honor,
is there one?
I don't know for a fact that there is, but if there was a prosecution under the criminal statute, he would then have the opportunity to once again argue vicarious consent and present the same evidence. And I believe it would be the burden of the prosecution to establish that he didn't act in good faith. And it is a higher legal standard than that which is present in this case. Now, the comments about 5285, there is no distinction about illegality versus inadmissibility. The statute simply says inadmissible. It doesn't say under these 15 categories. It simply says inadmissible. So to the extent that there's an argument that...
But excuse me, and I apologize for appearing from Las Vegas.
No need.
It's of concern to me. The court's ruling on January 5th, the last paragraph says, consistent with your argument, the court will allow Dr. Holland to testify regarding her expert opinion in this matter, which may be based in part upon the audio recordings. My concern with that is, if you credit that that was an illegal act of recording, how can you possibly explore the basis for the expert opinion without getting into the illegally obtained evidence? I'm not sure your reading of 5285 is correct, that there's not an implicit distinction. An expert cannot be a Trojan horse to admit opinions based on evidence that is not only inadmissible, but that was illegally obtained.
I understand, Your Honor, but that goes back to the issue of the fact that it hasn't been determined that they were illegally obtained. That hasn't been a finding. Illegality does not exist in this case. So that's why the distinction or the absence of a distinction in the evidentiary statute and just the reduction to inadmissibility is so important. Because in cases, as Mr. Smith spoke, in family court cases, when we have custody evaluations, and the important part about this one is
let me pause you for a moment, and again, it's hard because of the time delay. Do you or do you not concede that an expert may not rely on illegally obtained evidence?
I do not concede that. I don't believe the statute says that. I don't see any case law in Nevada that says that. The court cited Barrett versus...
So you would allow an expert to come to court and testify to opinions based on evidence that was obtained by a burglar going into your house and finding your diary and reading it to the expert? That would be okay?
It would depend on the circumstances. I think that is an example that even in family court wouldn't happen. But from the standpoint of what experts doing this exact job that Dr. Holland did routinely rely on, her testimony was exactly that she listens to audio recordings, she listens to recorded phone calls by their very nature in Nevada, which is a two-party consent jurisdiction, would be illegally obtained. Her testimony was very clear, and Mr. Smith, I think, miscites her testimony. In fact, when she was asked if she knew that the tapes were illegal, would she have used them, she specifically stated, and this is at notes 1234 of the record, that if the judge or both parties told me they were illegal, I wouldn't consider it. That was her exact testimony. Now, prior to that...
But she licensed the expert the judge licensed the expert to consider this evidence. So if we determined that it was illegally obtained, and we're interpreting 5285 for all cases, not just family court cases. So we do have on the table here the proposition, if you have illegally obtained evidence, Can an expert rely on that and bring it into the proceeding as the basis for opinions or not? I don't know. I don't know what.
Wouldn't there have to be a prior determination of illegality before
Absolutely.
That could apply? And in this case, there has been no such determination. Now, Dr. Holland testified specifically also, and this is where I think the questions that the court had earlier are exactly at the heart of the case, that she did the interviews, at least the second and possibly the third, before listening to the tapes. So the facts upon which the district court judge relied in the findings that the court specifically cited to about best interest were based upon interviews. And while if I were in Mr. Smith's shoes, I would also try to downplay the issue of a child exploding a house. In fact, when he drew the two houses, the report specifically says he referred to Dad's house as the fake house, where there was dust, and then the earthquake happened to destroy the fake house. So while I understand the desire to avoid the specific findings of fact, which that goes back to where I was, the party stipulated to this interview. So as far as an alternative means of testimony, Mr. Smith spoke about not wanting to call a six-year-old, but when the party stipulated to the interview being the basis upon which the court could rely, that's how we determined how the child would get to testify. And the findings of fact specifically avoided the tapes. I believe Mr. Smith is right. The judge was certainly wise in not making that an issue. Is it relevant? Absolutely. Maybe 5285 should be modified to have a child custody case exception, because we are dealing with the best interest. And that was probably my favorite question today was, well, you've talked about criminal statutes the first 5 minutes of your argument. Isn't this a child custody case? And my first comment was going to be, this is a child custody case, and the best interest of the child is all that the court was charged with. Now, in the history of family court, these types of reports happen. Evidence which is of questionable admissibility is routinely used, and that's why I went through the first 5 or 6 questions of Dr. Holland to establish that these types of things, as the example I used with phone recordings, are used because the best interest allows it. And because the way I think the district court interpreted 5285 is the way I did. If it doesn't say unless illegally obtained, inadmissibility is the standard, there is no distinction. Now, Dr. Holland's testimony, saying not only that experts routinely rely on this type of information, but also that she conducted the interviews prior to listening to the tapes, I think is conclusive of that issue. Now, the interviews themselves, the evidence that was revealed, Dad's testimony in trial, Mom's admissions to Dr. Holland that she tells the child, don't tell your father what happens in my house. That wasn't part of the tape.
Mr. Jones, you'd have to concede, though, that the tapes colored the expert's report in view of this matter.
I respectfully disagree in that there was one paragraph that referred to the tapes at the beginning, and that was just the records review paragraph. So that wasn't a substantive paragraph. It was saying, I reviewed the tapes, they said these things. There were 7 lines later on that mentioned the tapes, and yes, in the appendix there was a transcript of the tapes, but the facts that are contained in the interview, Dr. Holland knew the issue was alienation, knew the problems Dad was having, because Dad met with Dr. Holland, as Dr. Holland stated, she met with both parties, met with the child 4 separate times. So the facts that were developed based upon the concerns in the papers and pleadings, the concerns of Dad, the admissions of Mom, that's how she asked the child questions. But more importantly, the actions of the child and the statements of the child and the evidence elicited from the child had nothing to do with the tapes. And I think that's why Dr. Holland's testimony, the majority of it, dealt solely with the facts established from the child, not from the tapes. The tapes were mentioned very briefly in her testimony, but all she said was, I reviewed them after I conducted the interviews, and it made the interviews, it caused the interviews and the statements of the child to make more sense, having listened to the tapes. But even at the initial hearing in this matter, Mom admitted to the things that she said in open court. Mom admitted to Dr. Holland to certain aspects of what's contained in the report. So from that perspective, I think you can't assume that there was a taint, particularly given Dr. Holland's testimony that she didn't listen to the tapes until after she had established the issues with the child, and that is her typical practice in her, you know, in her review and doing these types of interviews. I think that's probably the best practice, but then again, I'm not the expert. She is. And I would never substitute my judgment for a PhD who has done this for that long, as established by her testimony, and for the testimony that she offered.
Let me ask you this. Assuming we found it was error to provide the tapes to the expert, you're indicating it's harmless error, and it doesn't affect substantial rights. You want to talk about that for a second?
Well, it's harmless error in that the district court didn't rely on the tapes. The district court specifically went to facts that were established by the statements of the child. They were also established, although the court didn't specifically say, also supported by dad's testimony or also supported by mom's testimony. I guess she could have gone that far because dad's testimony established what I believe, and the reason I made the argument that tapes probably should have been independently admissible, and they're cited on page 4 of my fast-track response, all of the places where what dad had witnessed with his son led him to the conclusion that there was something very, very wrong going on during this time and that he needed to do something about it. So from the standpoint of harmless error, the court didn't rely on the tapes. Dr. Holland didn't rely on the tapes in doing the interviews. The child spontaneously revealed what the child revealed. Mom spontaneously revealed what mom revealed. Those had nothing to do with the tapes, and because the decision did not involve a review or a discussion of the statements made by mom on the tapes, it would be harmless error that the tapes were submitted. I think the bigger issue is the court specifically relied on the statute and Barrett versus Baird in determining that an expert could review these tapes. And like I said before, in child custody evaluations and in child interviews, forensic analyses based solely on the best interest of the child, that's what the experts do. In fact, Dr. Holland's testimony, shortly before she testified regarding, actually right after she testified regarding the specific things that she routinely relies on as an expert, she says she tells the parents to give me anything and everything because she's dealing with the determination of best interest. That's a little bit more important than some of the arguments made in the papers and here today by the appellant. That's the one thing that has been absent from this record on the appellant's part, is any acknowledgement about the fact that what the child said in this report, in the interviews, establishes that she ever did a thing wrong. And that further evidence is that the court's decision was absolutely right. And to bolster my analysis with regard to the independent admissibility of the tapes, the decision, based upon the interviews of the child, if we went backwards to say, okay, this is what the court determined based upon what the child said, then I think that would support the finding that dad acted in good faith because the court determined ultimately that it was in the best interest of the child to reside primarily with mom. And I don't think that can be ignored. Now, from a standpoint of what can be accomplished from this, I think it probably makes some sense for this court to weigh in on the issue of vicarious consent. You've seen the citations. I think the most recent case out of New York, the Battle of Menti case, 27 New York 3rd, 423, does a more recent summary of the status of the law throughout the United States. But, you know, there are cases in Illinois and Louisiana that specifically dealt with whether a guardian ad litem could have reviewed illegally obtained tapes, and the court there found they could. And that's the Coronis case in Illinois and the Smith case in Louisiana that was cited in the fast-track statement. But I think Mr. Smith's argument that there needs to be some parameters makes a lot of sense. There shouldn't be an absolute ability for people to do things that are ultimately determined to be illegal, but there has to be some recognition that a parent can act in good faith in protecting his child. Now, as far as other possible results of this case, NRS 5285, based upon Justice Pickering's comments, maybe there needs to be some adjustments to that, so there's a clarification about illegality versus independently inadmissible. I'm not sure, but on this record, there's no basis for a reversal. The only thing that can result is an affirmance, and that's because while the appellant chooses not to focus on the best interest of the child, the district court did. Thank you.
Thank you. Smith, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you for the 2 minutes, Jerry. I think the answer to your question, Justice Peregrine, is found in Nevada Revised Statute 200-690, which reads, a person who willfully and knowingly violates NRS 620-650, which would include this statute, shall be punished by a Category E felony as provided by NRS 193-130. Took me a minute to find it as well, so thank you. This is a crime. Allowing criminal behavior to infect our custody actions would actually harm them. I think that we should have a procedure by which, it's similar to the procedure where litigants come and believe that there is something wrong with the situation and seek a warrant or some sort of judicial imprimatur on the propriety of what it is that they're doing.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
To answer the question that he ended with, why is this not in the best interest of the child?
Well, the question is it in the best interest of the child to allow parents to have surreptitious conversations in violation of statute?
That's not the question. The question is the best interest of the child.
Well, that would mean that anything that we do, regardless of whether it's in violation of law, could be deemed in the best interest of the child. So, for example, if somebody grabbed a child from a situation it felt was harmful, in violation of law, kidnapped the child, we should ignore the kidnapping because, well, hey, it was in the best interest of the child under the circumstances that he found when he kidnapped the child. That's not the way our law works. The rules of law are there to protect certain types of interests. This is an interest that needs protection. The privacy of individuals in their own home to have conversations not only with the child, but with their family members. Then the penalties are significant for this kind of...
Mr. Smith, I'd like to just ask this question. Assume for the moment that the court were to agree with you that this evidence should not have been considered by the expert. In reviewing the judge's decision, what is the standard of review? Is it not abuse of discretion?
It is.
And under that standard, if the court reviews the record, including the summary of interviews that were taken of the parents, the children, and others, what in the record, what in the decision of the judge in this case, the written decision, is an abuse of discretion?
The reliance solely upon statements made to an expert by a child. I don't think that we should allow without any corroborating evidence whatsoever.
So you're saying the sole basis of the judge's decision is the reliance on the taped information?
Judge, Justice Hardesty, I welcome you to review those findings.
Oh, I've read them.
Compare them to the report. You'll find they come directly out of the report. There is I challenge you to find any citation in the court's order to the testimony of the parents, the testimony of the spouses of the parents, or the testimony of the teachers. I think ignoring those, particularly in light of your decisions about the requirement of findings in order to change a custodial relationship, I think it's important.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones for your some arguments in this matter. We'll give you extra time because this is an important issue. Child custody, my colleagues and I believe that it's very, very important that we give you as much time as you need. So thank you for your participation. This matter is